Okay, everyone. My clock's showing 8:30, so let's begin. Connie, could you do roll call, please?
Yes, good morning, everyone. Commissioner Sandra Clark.
Present.
Commissioner Robin Grimway.
Present.
Commissioner Tamara Kaufman.
Present.
Commissioner Robert Liberty.
Here.
Commissioner Jerry Manynek. Commissioner Donna Mickley.
Here.
Commissioner Karina Miller. Commissioner Michael Mills.
Here.
Commissioner James Morgan. I see him there. Commissioner Roger Nichols.
Here.
Commissioner Patu Pitt.
Here.
Commissioner Ashley Thompson. And Commissioner Amy Weisfeld. Right.
Okay, moving on, can we do the approval of the February 8, 2022 Commission meeting minutes?
I'll move approval.
I'll second.
Any objections to the minutes? That's unanimous then, Connie. Okay, next item, land acknowledgement. Welcome to Columbia River Gorge Commission's March meeting. We begin today with a land acknowledgement. We acknowledge and honour that the Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area is located within the ancestral territories of Indigenous peoples who have protected these lands and waters since time immemorial. We also honour the sovereignty and the role of the four Columbia River Treaty Tribes in taking care of these lands and waters today. The Confederate Tribes of Warm Springs, the Confederated Bands and Tribes of the Yakima Nation, the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation and the Nez Perce Tribe. These bands and tribes include the Wasco, Warm Springs, Paiute, Cayuse, Umatilla, Walla Walla, Kayi, Milpa, Klickitat, Tlingit, Kaw'a, Sayi, Liwa, Ushots, Palus, Piskoa Sai, Chiksai, Stimpwa La La, Wentashampam, Wisham, Yakima, and Nimpui peoples. We are committed to working together with tribal governments through government to government and people to people partnerships. We offer this land acknowledgement in gratitude for all of those who have come before us and those cultivating respectful relationships today and into the future. In recognition of the historical and ongoing legacy of colonization and in commitment to work together toward a more just and equitable future and protection of our shared connection to those lands and waters.
Chair, I just wanted to let you know that Commissioner Weisfeld has joined the meeting.
Thank you. Okay. Has Commissioner Karina Miller joined us for Warm Springs word of the day?
I do not see her on my list at the moment. Maybe we could ask Commissioner Pitt if she has a word that she could share.
Sorry, I did not prepare something.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, maybe we could just come back to that.
Yeah, we'll come back. Next is, there's an opportunity for Treaty Tribe Nations to address the Commission as part of the government-to-government consultation process. The Commission welcomes input from Treaty Tribe Nations on any issue on the agenda and any other matters. Do we have anyone, Connie?
If there are any Treaty Tribe members in attendance today, if you would like to provide testimony on behalf of the Treaty Tribes, you could use the raise hand function. Don't see any raised hands, and I did not receive an email, Chair.
Thank you. Moving right along then, the next item is there is an opportunity for public comment for items related to the National Scenic Area that are not on the agenda. Do we have any public comment today?
Are there any members of the public in attendance that would like to provide testimony on Any item not on the agenda? If you could use the raise hand function. Any takers? I don't see any hands raised.
Okay, well, we'll then move on to our executive director's report. Christina.
Yes, good morning, commissioners. Good morning, members of the public that are with us today. We have a very short executive director's report today because we've been putting a lot of our energy into the ordinances and the climate change action plan that you'll be hearing about today. But I did want to give you an opportunity to hear from Mike Schrenkel on the Access Database Replacement Project, and we have just a quick slide to share with you on that. So Mike, take it away.
Hi, thank you, Christina. Connie, I don't seem to be able to share my screen, and I don't have a chat function to let you know that before time. So, oh, did you just bring your copy of it up?
Yes, I did, Mike, okay. Sorry.
Thank you. No problem. This will work just fine. I made a couple of small changes, but that's fine.
Oh, here, if you want.
No, it's fine. Just go ahead. The changes are so minor, it's not.
Okay.
Same.
Okay.
Yeah, so just to reiterate real quickly, the Access Database Project consists of two phases. We're in phase one right now. At the end of this phase, we will have identified a technical solution and submitted a funding request for the second phase, which is the actual implementation phase. And that's where the actual database will get built. So right now we're in this, we just finished gate one, which is the planning and initiation phase. I shouldn't say phase. The gate one is planning initiation. Gate two is needs assessment. And we've just moved into that phase. We actually just received formal approval of the completion of all the gate one deliverables from the Washington OCIO yesterday, which was a great milestone for us. We actually finished the work several weeks ago, but it's good to get that formal approval of that. So what you're seeing on the screen here is the dashboard that I use for our monthly executive steering committee meetings. And I like this because it just uses kind of a stoplight, a red, yellow, green stoplight for the scope, schedule, budget, and then the overall status of the project. So that's what those green dots mean in the upper right. That's significant to me because for a long time we had a yellow light in the schedule because we started off a little bit behind the eight ball, a little behind schedule for gate one, but we now have tied that up and we've, the great work of ESA Sitka has allowed us to get back on track, and we're all green all across the board now. Moving down to that next box, recent accomplishments. Like I said, we just finished gate one, began gate two, which is the needs assessment phase. That's where some of you have been involved. We've all been involved in this part. This is getting exciting for us because ESA Sitka has interviewed each one of our staff members. They've also talked to a couple of the commissioners. We still have one more to finish up this week. Actually, one more staff member. We've got one staff member, Aiden, of course, is out on family leave, but he's offered to sit down and talk to the ESA Sitka folks for a half hour to give some of his input because he's really got the best. As far as staff members, he has a lot of knowledge about the current database and should be able to offer them a lot of insight into that. So part of that gate two kickoff meeting included participating in a SWOT analysis, which is strength, weakness, opportunity, and threat. So we all, we had kind of a whiteboard that we could use and we could all be really open about what we saw as potential opportunities for the next database, what the weaknesses and strengths of the current one are. And then just kind of that leads into a risk and assessment analysis as well. So we're always being mindful of any risks we have that are going to affect the completion of the project or any steps along the way. That's what you're seeing down below in the key risks and issues. So for example, one of our current identified risks includes the, all of you know that we have a small staff here. So sometimes losing a single staff member can really greatly impact the project. So for example, it's easiest to use me. I'm not trying to put myself as more important than anybody else, but I'm the sole GIS person, subject matter expert on staff. So if I left, if I got sick, if I was unavailable, then that could impact the progress of the project moving forward because we are integrating GIS so much into the current database. So our action to mitigate that risk is to rely on other staff to fill in to the best of our abilities, or if we need to bring in some outside assistance as a last resort for that. Another risk that we've identified early on is that it's going to be difficult for the vendor to estimate the cost of alternative solutions. So they're going to come to us and they're going to have three or four different solutions that we can choose from. And a difficulty with that is they're talking about different software packages, and without knowing, having a good feel for the pricing of those software packages, it would be difficult to, for them to prepare that comparison. And so we added in a step to include a request for information prior to the finish of gate two, so that they'll have some pricing ideas and be able to present that to us in our range of solutions. Some of the next steps over the next month before the next time we meet, the vendors will be completing as-is and to-be workflows, which, just like it sounds, they're analyzing what our current workflow situation is and where we would like it to be in the future. That's also part of the gap analysis, where we are now compared to where we want to be, identifying the steps we need to get there. They will complete that RFI, request for information, to get some costing ideas for our solutions. They'll begin drafting their initial business and technical requirements, as well as the assessment of impacts to infrastructure and business processes. Those are a lot of big, long phrases that maybe don't exactly reveal what they are. But basically, just a lot of this phase is looking at where we are and where we want to be. That's really the goal of this current gate two. And then finally, just to reiterate some of the major milestones and deliverables, our investment plan, we submitted it at the end of January. It had to go through quite a few channels and folks to review it. They gave it back to us a couple of times for a few minor edits, and it was formally approved right at the beginning of the month here. And then, like I said, we received our certification from the Washington Office of the Chief Information Officer just yesterday, formally approving all of our gate one deliverables, and then that releases funding for us to begin the next gate. That was a lot in a short time. Is there any questions? None. Just want to finish up by saying really appreciate, I know Christina sent quite a few, if not all of you, set of questions to get some of your input in that as well. And we really appreciate getting that from you folks. It gives us a different perspective of what we might want out of this database that maybe the staff hadn't thought of. So thank you very much for all your participation and your thoughts on that. That's all I have.
Christina?
Okay. Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mike. This dashboard is really helpful because we try to update that frequently. It's online and it's easy for OCIO to see this as well as our staff. So then the next update, I'm going to ask Lisa to give you a little bit of an update on the Vital Sign Indicators project.
Okay. And Connie, we can, I guess, leave this up. I'll get to it in just a minute.
Okay.
So maybe just take it down for 1 second. Sure. Yeah. Just because I know it's exciting and it might be a little distracting. I just have a couple of different updates for all of you. Good morning, commissioners, and welcome to all who are joining us and listening in from the public today. For our VSI update, I have both a couple progress updates on work we're doing for the program and then some related announcements that we thought would be of interest to you. So first of all, we are continuing to work with Forest Service staff as well as the International Dark Sky of Oregon on our scenic indicator development. So we are on track to present those draft indicators to you next month in April. So stay tuned for that staff report at the end of, really at the beginning. It'll be a early first week of April to you. And secondly, we are also working with Forest Service folks on a letter of invitation to treaty tribes to learn more about the ways that we can support their climate priorities, both through the climate change action planning work that you're going to hear about later today and VSI. So as you've been hearing over the last year, you know, we've identified some of these shared priorities like cold water refuge, habitat for salmon and culturally important plants, as well as things like access for traditional gathering practices. And so we're following up on what we've been hearing from some staff already from the tribes. So we'll keep you posted on that effort. The two announcements that I have, Connie, I'm ready for the first slide there. These two announcements connect both with VSI and climate change action planning work. So we wanted to just give you this today as an example of something that we're already engaged in that is included in the draft in progress of the climate change action plan. So as you know, fire risk is one of the priorities in the plan, and the Gorge Commission recently joined the Washington Fire Adapted Communities Learning Network. If you're not familiar with what this is, I'll just briefly share, and we can talk more about it if anyone has questions during the work session later. But a fire adapted community is simply a community that understands the risks and are taking action to better prepare for, respond to, and recover from wildfire. So this is a national concept when you see this FAC. In Washington, this particular effort is a peer learning network that supports local action and on-the-ground projects while connecting people to resources to help us better live with the future and current present of wildfire and anticipating the effects of climate change. So this map here shows you that there's a variety of different organizations, agencies, and community-based groups that are part of this learning network. And within our geography, you can see that we are kind of filling this area now here in the Gorge region where there wasn't previously any formal member. And so we're hoping to just be able to learn more and work with a lot of the different counties and communities here that might be interested in learning and building some of these tools into their own wildfire resilience work. So the website is listed there if anybody is interested in learning more, but happy to talk more about this later. Just an example of something new that we are engaged in and connects with both VSI and climate change action planning. Next slide. And the last update I have is about the East Cascades Oak Partnership. I wanted to build off of the wonderful presentation that Commissioner Mickley shared with you last month as part of the Forest Service update. She talked about the oak release restoration work that's happening on Forest Service lands here in the scenic area and mentioned this partnership. And this is a large partnership, and their geographic area is broader than just the scenic area. But I wanted to, you know, remind folks that are listening in and you commissioners that the Gorge Commission has been involved with this group from the beginning, and as is the Forest Service, and they have quarterly meetings. And their next one is next month, and you are rather next week from 8 to 12. And if anyone is interested in learning more about oak restoration and conservation efforts in the area, you may contact Mary Bushman. The best way to learn more is to get on their mailing list. And a couple of topics that they will be focusing on that may be of interest to you, they are to us as staff, is of course climate and fire history in the East Cascades. They're going to be looking at traditional knowledge of fire use by Warm Springs tribes in the East Cascades as well, and then some oak wildlife focused topics as well. So opportunities to get in the field this summer, as well as join online meetings, and happy to answer any questions. But a key partner for us in building our oak vital sign for monitoring, and also a priority area in the draft climate change action plan. And that's all I have. Thank you for your time.
Christina, back to you.
Yeah, are there any questions from commissioners?
Commissioner Nichols?
Yes, I was concerned that, is there a similar program in the state of Oregon for FireWire's communities that we should be joining as well?
Yeah, actually this fire adapted communities concept is national. There isn't a organized learning network in the same way, as far as I'm aware. There are communities that are doing things across Oregon, but it's a good a good question. And I think because of our geography, there's a little bit overlap. You saw like Sustainable Northwest is a Portland-based organization that is still a member of the Washington Learning Network. But yeah, I can continue to kind of look into that. Not a formal network that's truly analogous, but efforts going on for sure.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for the question.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner Morgan has his hand raised. I apologize.
Yeah, thank you. I did have a question about these fire adaptive communities, because it's one of the parameters that is being listed in the Climate Change Action Plan as something that we would want to potentially monitor or measure over time. Could you talk a little bit about what would constitute a fire adaptive community?
Yeah, it's...
Go ahead.
Oh, please. Sure. And Commissioner Morgan, too, I think that you, I should mention this. We did have Hillary Lundgren, who's the coordinator, present at our forest workshop that was part of climate change action planning in September. So if people are interested in more of this, we have some great graphics that I think illustrate this. But there's a wheel, and there's just a lot of different ways that people and communities can be engaged and sort of consider themselves a fire adapted community. And it looks different at every place that you're in. So some may be focused more on actual prevention. Some may be focused on mitigation. So I could provide some more information on kind of that whole suite of different activities and approaches, but there isn't necessarily like it's not the same as like a FireWise credential per se, but it's more of an approach for building resilience that is considering forest health as well as community well-being. So we've got a great slide that could get more into that if you're interested, and I can follow up more with Jessica too during that work session if you have more questions.
Well, thank you. Maybe I didn't phrase my question correctly, and this is probably something for later during the Climate Change Action Plan discussion, but I was, and I do remember that presentation, what it means to be a fire adaptive community, but I don't know when we, if we're using that as a parameter, when do we check the box? Is it when you adopt an ordinance, or is it when you're completely fire protected, or how do we actually determine when a community is a fire adaptive community? Is it a political action or is it an on the ground action? And maybe this is a later discussion.
I think for our purposes of, yeah, what our role would be as an agency, that would be something that we would want to be discussing. I think when we use that term and how it's currently in listed as an action, one of the basic actions was just to be a part of this network and to be using it as a learning opportunity to actually impact the policies that we would develop. But the other question that we can still be exploring is how we might work with interested communities to build that understanding of what they want to pull from kind of this menu to define themselves as a fire adapted community. So our role and how we engage with others, I think, is something that we want to talk more about. But there isn't what we would consider checking a box, I think, is something that we need to have a conversation about. There isn't like a predetermined, this is what a fire adapted community it looks like that each one has. It's really something that they are pulling from and defining for themselves.
Okay, thank you.
But I think it's a good question for us and how we would define it going forward and how we would want to be working with others in our geography. Jessica, do you have anything else to add to that?
Yeah, I think it's a great topic for more discussion for sure. But I think one initial thought I have, and it's written into the current actions that would be sort of a check the box. First is joining the network, and then a secondary action is to explore a foundation of the learning network is to develop assessments for different communities. And so Lisa mentioned that every fire adapted community is unique, and it's a tailored approach to meet their needs. Starts with a multi-party collaborative assessment of how are we doing, how fire prepared are we, where are our strengths and weaknesses, and where do we need more resources and attention. And so we think that it could be a really valuable asset to help partners develop that sort of self-assessment as a first step. So that's another opportunity to sort of check that we're making progress on that. And then in future action planning, we're looking at those more specific outcomes of that self-assessment and what those needs are that we need to fill.
Thank you.
And I should mention too that Trout Lake, although it's outside the scenic area, is engaged in a fire adapted community effort right now. So that's one local example to just be kind of paying attention to. And we've heard from a few folks, somebody in Hood River, there's some general interest in what it could mean. And so we just want to explore, advancing that conversation and seeing what our role could be. But thank you for the question, Commissioner Morgan.
Anything else to add, Christina?
Yeah, I just wanted to give you a heads up about April. So in the next month, as part of our roadmap, we are going to be looking at the scenic indicators for VSI. And so Lisa will be on deck to be able to give us more of an update of where we are with the scenic resources. We're also going to be looking at the budget and the budget process and what we will be thinking about in terms of preparing for our 2023-2025 budget, get some initial ideas from commissioners, and that will help us prepare a budget for your adoption, hopefully by May or June coming up. And then we will have another governance training lined up for everyone. We're not sure exactly which the topic is, but we will be discussing that at executive committee. And then finally, I just wanted to let the other commissioners know that I was notified by Commissioner Menynek and Commissioner Thompson that they are not able to join us today because of family issues that took priority. They were emergencies. So they wanted to send their apologies that they could not be here today with you. That's it for me today.
Thank you.
Commissioner Liberty has his hand raised.
Commissioner?
Director Volnikovsky, I think I originally recall we were going to have the results of the Klickitat County pilot study in April.
Yes, Aiden is still out on family leave, and so we are going to make sure that he has time to wrap up that study before we present it to you. So I'm not going to promise you the results in April, which is why I did not mention it, because we want to give Aiden an opportunity to transition back. He's only going to be working one day a week, starting at the end of March. So I'm not sure that we can actually get everything wrapped up and in a way to present it to you by the April commission meeting. So we're going to try to move that to the May commission meeting.
Madam Director, I'm not complaining about Aiden's family leave. I'm just wanted to know when it would be on the agenda so I'd have time to prepare.
Yes, we've been in contact with Aiden and everything's good, but we may have to postpone that for another month until May.
Commissioner Weisfeld has her hand raised.
Yeah, thanks. I apologize if this question is just a newbie kind of question, and I probably will be saying that sort of thing for many, many months, but I wanted to first thank Mike for the clarity of the presentation on the Access Database project, which was super helpful to me. The format and the way it was laid out and the explanation of the traffic light system was really great. And I don't know if the plan is to do something similar on the VSI metrics or not, but that would be super helpful if that is part of the plan or something similar. Thanks.
Thank you. Good suggestion. We're always looking for how to present a lot of information in a pretty crisp, clear, graphic way. So thanks for that. Any other questions?
Anything else, Christina? Okay, let's move on then. Commissioner Mickley, Forest Service update.
Yeah, so the big focus of what I'm working on right now is related to the pilot project for the waterfall corridor. We are running into authority issues between jurisdictions. We'd like to do this. It's a timed ticket entry permit system, you know, really similar to what we're doing on the I-84 parking lot. It's about metering how many folks can get through at one time. You check in for the time that you enter. You can stay as long as you like. We're really wanting to use rec.gov so that it's not confusing for the public if they're driving the highway or they're using the parking lot. The issues that I'm running into is the Forest Service authority and policies and being able to use this system. And we've got to collect a fee for the contractor that runs the ticketing process. That's the only fee there is. There isn't any fee for access. It's really a fee for the ticket system. We can only use that on federal land. So the fact that it's mixed jurisdiction, that it's ODOT's road and it's intermixed with state parks. We're having a lot of high level Washington office discussions about can we find a way to use this system? And I have several more meetings set up. If we get to a place where it just is not within our authority, then we may have to postpone this effort or look at a smaller section that's only for service land. But we've had a lot of high level conversations. The state ODOT doesn't have the authority. The parks have the same issue that we have. They have a system and a process, Reserve America, that works for the parks, not able at this time to work across those boundaries. So I just highlight that for the group that we continue, it may take changes congressionally. It may take a really high level policy changes that will take us some time to make. But I think the Gorge is an area where we certainly are all interested in figuring out how do we find the right authority and how do we change the authorities that we have so that we can do things like this so we can most efficiently co-manage. But I just want to share with you all that it sounds like a simple thing to do. It's really not simple, and we're trying really hard to work it out. So any questions on that before I go to my next update?
Commissioner Morgan?
Commissioner Mickley, I attended that meeting last week with the on the pilot project, and you know, ODOT did much of the presentation as well as parks, and the way it was conveyed to the public was there was a private vendor that was going to manage the permit system, and it wasn't really clear if you were talking about the same entity, or is it just an unnamed entity, or is it, as you say, a confusion of three entities? Any clarification?
Sure. The intent is really to use rec.gov. Rec.gov is run by a contractor. So we have a contract for that service, and we have direction that any fees that are collected throughout the Forest Service uses the rec.gov system. State Parks has something very similar, but their system is Reserve America. So our authorities, they have state authorities, we have federal authorities. Currently, there has not been an authority that's designed to be able to use intermixed across state and federal. And so we're just bumping up to this limitations of our authorities. But that conversation and who ODOT was referring to was actually Forest Service contract with Reserve America. Or I'm sorry, recreation.gov.
Thanks.
Commissioner Liberty. Commissioner, you're on mute.
Commissioner Mickley, this sounds like a description of what the Gorge Commission was created for, right? This mixture of state and federal authority and dealing with recreation sites and so on. Is there anything in the state compact or federal legislation, given Congressman Blumenauer's interest in legislation, that could be used to address this problem? I mean, an amendment, I should say.
Yeah, I think that's maybe quite where we land and what we need. Yes, can we do that between now and May? Not likely, but certainly that's the long-term solution. I'm not sure that we can get to it in time for this summer.
I appreciate that. If it was even next summer, that would be great. But I mean, when you describe the problem, I think that's why we exist, right?
Yes, and we're special, and we need some special designations to do what we're being asked to do and want to do. I see another question.
Oh, it was just, yeah, Commissioner Mikkel, I just wanted to thank you. I know how arduous and painful trying to coordinate agencies, and I just want to thank you for not throwing up your hands and saying we can't do this and trying to figure out a solution. So appreciate it.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
Before we proceed forward, Chair, I did have a call yesterday from public member Erwin Hagland, and he did want to provide some testimony today during public comment. We were quite a bit ahead in the agenda, and he has logged in. And I know that Commissioner Mikkel has not finished her presentation, but just want you to know that he is there, and you can make a choice whether to take his testimony after the Forest Service presentation.
We continue with the Forest Service presentation.
Okay.
Okay, just a couple more updates. Obviously, spring has sprung and we're getting really busy ahead of time, as many people are with the east side, especially Catherine Creek, Coyote Wall. So we just got the ticketed permit system up and operational at Dog Mountain. And so we don't have much reprieve in these days with visitation slowing down. There's a slight slowdown, but again, we're about to ramp up. And just one other thing I'll share. We had an accident at Multnomah Falls over the weekend, which is not unusual. Those happen pretty frequently. Part of why we're trying to put these systems in place. But this time, they actually impacted our sewage treatment plant. We're in the middle of a construction contract to upgrade and improve that. So they actually hit a tree, but hitting the tree disturbed the lines underneath, and we ended up having a raw sewage issue. So we're in the middle of the cleanup, but it's, you know, just the domino effects of, you know, and as law enforcement reported the accident and dealt with the tree, you know, there was really no way to anticipate that we had underground damage that had occurred from that. So I think we're working on a repair, and DEQ is involved, and it's contained, and we didn't need to take the restrooms down at the lodge. We got a holding tank that we can kind of pump every day to continue services, but just some of the nuances of the day-to-day business that I thought I'd share. And Casey's got a follow-up on the question about SMA forest practices that we can continue with now or delay, whatever you would like.
Sure. We continue, thanks. Casey.
Yeah, thanks, Chair Grimwade. And this is in response to the question you had asked at last month's meeting for some clarification on how the Forest Service processes SMA forest practices. And so, Connie, if you wouldn't mind pulling up that slide. And I guess, you know, one thing I'll preface this with as well is that this process of how we review SMA forest practices is similar to how, you know, your staff, as well as the counties, process other consistency and development reviews in the National Scenic Area. There's a lot of similarity between these two processes. And so I know Jeff next month is having a, you know, or starting a series on the act and the plan and whatnot. And so you'll identify a lot of overlap between this process and again, that consistency review across the scenic area. I think go to the next slide. one of the things that, you know, often gets asked is the SMA versus the GMA forest practices, and you know, why is there the Forest Service engagement with the SMA and then we don't have that same engagement with the GMA? So one of the things I wanted to just highlight here was the savings provision with the rights and responsibilities of non-federal timber landowners. And so it's highlighted there, it's coming directly out of the act. And it's just, you know, basically saying that except for the management of non-federal lands within the SMA, nothing shall affect the rights and responsibilities of those non-federal timber landowners in Oregon and Washington. When we look at federal lands, whether it's GMA or SMA, we treat all federal forest practices or any resource enhancement project that's reviewed as a forest practice as SMA, regardless of the underlying land use designation. Next slide. So from the Act and the plan, you know, the Act is there to protect and enhance the natural, cultural, scenic, and recreation resources as, you know, the first of the two purposes. And so the goal for forest land is to protect and enhance forest lands for forest uses. And that's for the SMA, the goal of that land use designation. And when we look at forest practices, there's the policy that site plans shall be prepared by the applicant for any forest practice, which is similar to any other review use. And then in number five there, you see where the Forest Service shall, you know, working with, in this case, it's the state regulatory agencies, review those forest practices for consistency and compliance with the forest practice guidelines. And that's to protect those scenic, cultural, natural, and recreation resources. So that's kind of the underlying policy and goal for the review of those SMA forest practices. One of the things, next slide, one of the things to note is that SMA forest practices, while they primarily occur, or where we typically see them is in the forest land use designation, they're also permitted review uses in other land use designations. When we look at open space, is there a question, Commissioner Greenwood?
I don't believe so, Casey.
Okay, sorry, I thought I heard someone jump in. And feel free if you have a question to interrupt me, happy to answer those. You know, this was one that we had some questions about was in the SMA open space. And so when we look at the review uses of that land use designation, we can see that 2B there is that resource enhancement projects for the purpose of enhancing the scenic, cultural, recreation, and natural resources are a review use in the open space, and that those projects may include vegetation management and forest practices subject. And it ties back to that forest land use designation guidelines in part two, chapter three. When we, again, this is for open space. If you go to the next slide, Connie, you'll see that for agriculture, residential, and recreation land use designations, there's a similar tie back to those forest land use designations. And so even when there's a forest practice in one of these other land use designations, it ties back to those forest practice or to that forest land use designation.
Casey?
Commissioner Liberty?
I'm sorry, it's just, I can't read any of this.
This is all coming directly out of the management plan itself.
No, I understand that. I'm just saying when you're doing a presentation, I have a laptop, I can't read any of that.
Okay. And I think the presentation, I sent it to Connie and she'd be happy to send it. I'm sure it's part of the commission materials and so.
No, it would be helpful to me if we use like a standard 28 point for excerpts and stuff, and just rather than me having to open another screen and watch it. Right, thank you.
Okay. So these other land use designations, again, agriculture, residential, recreation, there are all review uses listed there. That shows where forest uses and forest practices are a reviewed use. And again, those all tie back to making sure that they comply with the guidelines in the forest land use designation itself. I think that's the takeaway here. So how does this process actually play out, in the real world? Next slide, Connie. Typically, landowners are more familiar with, or landowners who complete forest practices are familiar with either of the states. In Oregon, it's the Department of Forestry, or in Washington, it's the Department of Natural Resources. And so typically, those landowners connect with those two state agencies as one of their first steps. One of the things that we do is we, the Forest Service, and each of those state agencies connect on a yearly basis just to talk about, you know, what's happened over the past year, what's been some opportunities for us to improve the process when we're talking about SMA forest practices. And so again, we meet with them once a year. I think this last year, the commission staff, I think Aiden joined in on some of those just to be a part of the conversation and listen in. And it's just an opportunity for us to talk about that process of a landowner comes to them. Both of those state agencies are very aware of the SMA responsibilities that those landowners have. And so typically a landowner will come to them first and they'll do that first check. And if they identify it's SMA, then they'll bring us into the mix. If that step happens to get missed somehow, those notifications or applications are publicly posted. And so I get notification of all of those. I know your staff does as well. And typically when there's one that's near an SMA land use designation, we'll just double check with the agency to make sure that they confirm on the ground that the proposed forest practices is either not in the SMA, or if it is in the SMA, that we go through this review for consistency with the management plan. And so even just last week, I think Jessica said, hey, Casey, there's this forest practice I saw. Can you please double check and confirm with the state that they have identified where that GMA and SMA boundary is? So just in case that first step, you know, gets missed or overlooked on accident, your staff, as well as me and my staff, do review all of those forest practices that have geographies within the National Scenic Area. So when we talk about the forest land use designation itself, again, similar to all land use designations in the national, or all development reviews in the National Scenic Area, there is a review use for those in the forest land use designation, and that's review use X in the SMA. Next slide, Connie, and I'll apologize now, Commissioner Liberty. There's a lot of information in these slides, and I wanted to just tie directly to the management plan so that there was clear understanding of, you know, where this is coming from. I don't know that the purpose was necessarily to be able to see the individualized text of each of these things, but just to know exactly where that information is and what I'm referring to. So in the SMA forest land use designation in X, it identifies and highlights all the different things that an SMA forest practice has to look at and review as part of a complete application to be a reviewed use. And so again, that's in part two, chapter two, the SMA guidelines review use X. And so to keep you from having to, you know, read this, I just wanted to put it in here just so you know exactly where that is. I think, you know, the specifics of those probably aren't super critical for us at this moment, but the things that have to be in those completed applications are the size, locations of temporary roads, permanent roads, streams, any buffers, anything that would help us with the review for the protection and enhancement of the scenic, natural, cultural, and recreation resources has to be included in those applications, just like other development reviews here in the National Scenic Area. If you want to go down two more slides, Connie, to the table. Those slides above were just the guideline X directly out of the management plan. It's about five pages for just that review use itself. And so there's a lot of specifics of what's required for any of these SMA forest practices that we review. This table is in the SMA forest practices, and this kind of outlines what we look at and what's an allowable use within those. And so there are different forest vegetation types based on the natural vegetation here in the National Scenic Area. And within those, there's different forest structures, types of forest openings, how much opening there can be at any individual time, how many leave trees or a percentage of leave trees. When we talk about downwood, which is large wood on the ground, as well as snags, which are standing dead trees that provide habitat for wildlife. And so this table outlines explicitly what all of those criteria need to be met for a forest practice to be consistent with the management plan. And it's pretty explicit. If we look at a West conifer, you know, the forest structure is 60 to 80% canopy closure. We look at the percent openings and it's, you know, up to 10%, or not to exceed 8% in the West and 4% for the gorge walls and canyon lands. We look at the leaf trees and the downwood and the snags, again, very specific, 10 snags at 10 to 20 inch diameter and 7 snags greater than 20 inch diameter. And so the plan provides very specific guidelines for how this table is to be met. Within this, there is opportunities when this table doesn't meet the needs of that forest, right? Sometimes what's prescribed here doesn't meet the future needs of that forest. When, and so once anybody would like to deviate from the information in this table, they have to then develop a stewardship plan. All of that information above outlines what's required in a stewardship plan. And what that is intended to do is to provide what is the long-term vision for this forest. A great example of that would be Camp Arrowhead, which is a Girl Scout camp over in Washington. They had some diseased trees come in and affect their ability to work in the Girl Scout camp because of the risk of those trees falling. And so they ended up having to cut down, you know, much more than that 8% opening. And so what they had to do was create a stewardship plan that said, you know, here is what we're looking to do. It's to remove this infection and to replant. And here's why we're going to be meeting these guidelines in the next, you know, through the multiple steps of the stewardship plan. So if somebody doesn't want to meet these guidelines explicitly, they have to create a long-term vision for how they're going to bring this forest back into a healthy, resilient forest. We work with the landowners, as well as the two states, the three parties, all work in concert with each other to review all of these guidelines. And so typically, you know, landowners will come to us with a vision and we'll sit down and we'll spend quite a bit of time talking with them about, you know, what is it that they want? What is their goals? What is their restrictions to help them meet the guidelines within the management plan for this review use? Next slide, Connie. So once they do that, there's a completed application. This is just a sample of an application and a stewardship plan. You don't need to see what's in here, but these applications are the ones that are sent out for public comment for 30 days. These are sent to all stakeholders. We maintain a list of stakeholders here in the gorge, as well as all of the tribes. And so this is, you know, what gets sent out, and the public then has 30 days to provide comment on that. When a stewardship plan is required, like I said, for the Camp Arrowhead, a Girl Scout camp, that stewardship plan is attached to that application so that the land, so that the public can see those. And these stewardship plans, as well as the applications, are often, you know, fairly in depth with all the maps and all the information that anybody would need to help provide, you know, effective comments on that. And again, we still have to make sure that we're going back and meeting all the guidelines in the SMA forest practices. After that application period is closed and we've gotten all the comments and we've looked at them and made sure that it meets all the guidelines in the management plan, not just in the forest land use designation, just like all the review uses here in the National Scenic Area, but also part one, which is the protection guidelines for natural, cultural, scenic, and recreation resources. And so in addition to just these land use designations that have these very specific things for forests and forest practices, we also use, again, just like every other development review, all the components in part one of the management plan to make sure that we're protecting those scenic, natural, cultural, and recreation resources. Next slide, Connie. So once that's completed and we've completed that review, the next thing is we issue the consistency determination. And so this outlines how we're meeting each of the required guidelines in the management plan, as well as any conditions associated with that. This consistency determination is very similar to the ones that your staff prepares for Klickitat County, as well as each of the counties as well. Once that's complete, Then it goes back to the state. Next slide, Connie. At this point, that's when DNR or ODF works with the landowner to make sure that they're meeting the State Forest Practice Act. Typically, our management plan provides most or more restrictive requirements, but the state still has the responsibility to ensure that they're meeting the State Forest Practice Act. And so in this application from Washington DNR, you can see that they've identified that it's SMA, Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area, and they have identified explicitly that it came with CRG NSA consistency determination CD2002S. And so Washington DNR ties that specifically into their application. DNR will not process an application before they have this consistency review. The process is a little bit different in the state of Oregon, but essentially, ultimately it's the same process where they work with the landowner and pause operations until we get this consistency review. In Washington, all the guidelines or all those restrictions, all those conditions that we apply to the National Scenic Area Consistency Determination are brought directly into the DNR application and decision as well. And so once the landowner works with DNR or ODF on the state forest practice side of things, that's when they can then move forward. And so we continue to work with the landowner, ODF and DNR through the implementation of that, just to help the landowner make sure that if there's any questions about the consistency review, the conditions applied to the consistency determination, as well as the implementation that it's following through with those. So I think, Connie, that's the last slide. Yep. And I'd be happy to answer questions about that process.
Commissioner Liberty has his hand raised.
Commissioner?
Thank you, Casey. Despite the frustration not being able to read the text, that was very helpful, and I appreciate the overview. Can you tell me, I think it's been resolved, the challenge to one of the, I think it was enhancement projects that we heard about a couple months ago. Can you describe that in the context of the process for review and how that was resolved?
So that was a resource enhancement project in the open space that was being completed as a forest practice. And so that one tied into that open space land use, that review use. And so we went through it the same way that we went through all of them, where we looked at the, the guidelines in the chapter, made sure that it met all of those, and then issued the decision once we were able to clearly determine that it met those. I know Friends and the state ended up, or Friends challenged DNR and the state on that. And so honestly, it would probably be better to ask Friends. I don't know. It was resolved without us. It was resolved between the state and Friends of the Gorge. My understanding is that because they resolved it, there was nothing left for us to do.
Just a follow-up question. As I recall that, looking at the material you provided to us, one of the issues was whether or not the status of the forest land was properly classified, and therefore what kind of canopy closure would be required. Is that right? Do you remember that part of the discussion?
I don't remember that piece, to be honest.
All right, well, perhaps we can hear more about that. Is there one last question then? So is the way it work is that if people have concerns about a determination, their opportunity is an appeal through the DNR or Department of Forestry?
So there would be two opportunities to appeal that. First would be through them. In the management plan itself, it says that if there is there's an opportunity to appeal our decision to the regional forester of the Forest Service. And so there's two remedies prior to litigation. And Jeff may be able to speak on that, but.
So that would be an appeal to the regional forester, or they could wait and appeal.
The state forest practice decision.
And where does that appeal go, do you know?
that's a DNR product. I'm not actually sure.
All right, thank you.
Chair Michael Lang with Friends has his hand raised, and then so does Commissioner Weisfeld. Would you like to hear what Mr. Lang?
Let's do Commissioner Weisfeld first.
Okay, Commissioner.
Yeah, thank you. I'm just curious what percentage of the NSA is SMA? How much land are we talking about?
Throughout the National Scenic Area, and your staff, please jump in. I believe it's around 40% GMA, 40% SMA, and then 20% urban area. I think that's a rough general, and please feel free to jump in if I'm way off there.
Okay, and thank you for the overview. Super helpful, like a little tutorial for me. Appreciate it.
Okay, let's move to Michael Lang for a comment.
Michael?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the commission. I actually was going to address the Synergy Forest Practice and public comment. Was that moved back in the agenda, or was it brought up early? So I'm happy to talk about that during general public comment.
Let's do it in general public comment.
Okay, I'll just save my comments on Synergy. Yeah. Thank you.
Any other questions? Any further information, Donna?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
We didn't, I'm sorry, I thought I had the agenda from me. I thought we already passed public comment.
Yeah, I've got to open it because of Mr. Hagland.
Ah.
So yeah, okay. That's it for the Forest Service.
Thanks, Commissioner Mickley. Okay, I want to keep this very short and brief. Public comment was officially on the agenda around 9 o'clock. I would encourage people for public comment to make sure they're here ahead of the agenda time so we don't have to keep going back over it. I'm also mindful that I have a number of representatives from various counties for a report consideration at 9:35. Mr. Hagland, I will open public comment for you. It is 3 minutes. Please be brief and to the point.
Mr. Hagland?
Hey, good afternoon.
Are you there, Mr. Hagland?
I am, yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Anyway, I called in last time about our property in Hood River, currently zoned F2. I guess I was disappointed that we only got 6 minutes at the last meeting to talk about it because we were requesting. We were hoping to present facts and figures and for our side of the case on how the current management plan doesn't reflect our current zoning. Staff report that was written up surprisingly did not go through. We've also been really disappointed that we haven't been able to get answers and questions. Haven't been able to get responses from the director back or meet with our representative. COVID is an excuse why we can't show up in person. I know all the mandates are getting lifted. I don't know. We're hoping to see how without notification about the process until we got our Measure 56 notice. We had no participation in the process and how we're losing our rights because of that. Remember, I sent a long email chain, about a dozen questions apiece, of which was requesting justification. Yet to see that, and I'm just curious how the commission as a whole can justify taking away our rights without giving us any justification. Baffled by that. Also, we're curious about, as do approve county's ordinances, when they're going to take effect. somewhere late timeline. Secretary of Ag is going to. And then my last question, and I've been trying to meet with for this, is what's the process? What items that I requested a written response? Just hopefully appeal this to get our zoning corrected. It says clearly in the management plan that anyone can request a plan amendment, but we're being denied that. Stonewalled for 6 months now. Frustrating process. Hoping that as the governors lift the COVID restrictions, we'll be able to come in and get this, hopefully meet in person and talk in hours. Corrected. So, is the commission able to answer a few of those questions?
Mr. Hagland, you will recall at the February meeting of the commission unanimously resolved not to move forward with making an amendment to the plan of management. Furthermore, all public testimony at that meeting overwhelmingly expressed extreme concern about any consideration of a rezoning. The staff have been responsive to your request. There have been numerous emails, letters sent to you by the executive director. What is confusing to me, and maybe to other commissioners, is that at one time you wanted to swap the land and do a land swap with another organisation. You then went ahead and submitted an application for forest practices. It appears to me you're trying to run multiple ideas as they come up. And I would encourage you to go and sit down with a planning consultant and make a formal application to the relevant authorities to deal with the matter. But all we are doing is going round and round in circles. It's frustrating for you, and it is tying up staff which could be better spending their time dealing with issues that might be able to bring forward some of the concerns you have. So I would encourage you to really go and have a talk to a planning consultant and work out exactly with them what is permissible under the current rulings. Do we have any other comments or questions?
And so can I respond to that?
No, Mr. Hagland, I'm afraid you can't. That is the decision of the chair.
Back wrong, though, in the
Connie, will you please cut Mr. Hagland off?
I did.